for Ethnic Studies 112, Dr. Perales' class. This is Cesar Garcia, and I'll be interviewing John Guerra. It'll be taking place at John's apartment, and the date today is November the 25th, year 2001. All right, John, can you tell me about your family history and what you experienced as you were growing up? Parents, grandparents?
All right. I was born from parents, one of American nationality and one who naturalized as a citizen in the early 70s. My father, he's born and raised in Mexico, in Mexico City. And my mother was born and raised in Denver, Colorado, in the Back Hills known as Evergreen, Colorado. I grew up in San Diego, of mostly Latino neighborhoods, where, because of the color of my skin, I was never really considered Mexican, but because of my heritage, I was never really considered an American. So somewhere therein, I stood on top of a fence with my Mexican friends on one side, my American friends on the other. The times that stand out clearly in the division of the two families was I used to, when I was, from the years when I was 8 to about 14, every other summer, spend the whole summer in Mexico, whether it was Mexico City, Guadalajara, Durango, or down in Acapulco. I got to see various areas of Mexico and various parts of the culture within the culture. And the reason why those stand out so distinctly is because there was a true sense of family, a true sense of, how should we say, closeness within family members, you know, where you can see the elders, mostly my grandmother, because my grandfather passed away really before I could catch any time with him. But my great-grandfather was around, where their age and wisdom was regarded as knowledgeable and as a necessity and as a leading part of the family. Whereas on my mother's side, we're also the unfortunate didn't get to experience time with my grandfather. Whereas the older people were more of a burden, you know, more outcast. And there wasn't a true sense of a family. Anytime there was any kind of a get-together, be it a holiday or some kind of get-together, there was always division among the family. Whereas in Mexico, it was more of a celebration of all the family.
So how did the two different sides of your family get along?
Well, my two grandmothers got along the best, I would imagine, because neither of them could speak the other's language. So here you have, I kind of call it a Laurel and Hardy relationship, because my grandmother from Mexico is about 6 foot tall woman, very strong, dominant woman, very proud woman, whereas my mom's mom, my other grandmother, she's about 4 foot 11, maybe 5 foot, and much smaller, and these two would get along very well, trying to speak the unwritten language of kitchen ethics and meal preparation. Larger events where the two cultures met, mostly the younger people got along well, whereas some of the people on the mother side of the family, that they didn't want to learn to speak Spanish or they had trouble with another language, really found it uncomfortable mixing. Whereas, you know, people from my father's side of the family are very social and very warm. You know, they would try and, you know, and socialize and intermingle. And, but you could see the one side, you know, reaching out the hand while the other side was folding the arms.
So, assuming you more closely assimilate to the Mexican side of your family?
Most definitely. One of the true gifts that I picked up from my father, my grandmother, my great-grandfather is that social status didn't really matter. We learned to speak with people, whether they were homeless or whether they were royalty, because people are people. And that's one of the things that I share now with my children that I think is a blessing that we got from that side of the family.
So, when you grew up, who were your best friends as you grew up?
Well, in my younger days, probably from the time I was the reason why I say from I was 8 to about the time I was in high school was because we lived in one area. Before the time I was 8, we lived in Brazil. So growing up, more of my early adolescence, most of my friends were, you know, people from my neighborhood and people from my school. And the area I lived in was, they called it 33% white, and white included Orientals. Everybody else was Latino or black. So most of the majority of my friends were all Mexicans in the neighborhood that I grew up in.
So did you ever experience any, like, racism towards you or towards your friends when you were growing up? Do you remember any experiences?
I have two experiences of racism. One day, I was probably 11, 12 years old. We were playing touch football on the street. And it was me, probably 8 or 10 of my friends. And we saw, we lived close enough to the border in San Diego to where, you know, the word illegal alien really didn't apply because there were so many people, you know. And two guys came running up the street, obviously a little bit older and obviously running from something. And they were Hispanic. And when we asked what was going on, they said that the migra was chasing them. And so, you know, my friends and I, of course, we blocked the street with our game. And sure enough, an immigration vehicle came. And now you have to imagine those, you know, a dozen kids, all, you know, pretty much Hispanic. And when the migra came running around the corner in their little car, they stopped and they asked where these guys had gone. And I started speaking back to them and, you know, telling them to go back and, you know, to get a different job. And of course, I was saying a lot of bad words in Spanish to them. So they took my smart attitude and started giving me a hard time. And next thing I knew, they were processing me for deportation. So me and about 3 of my friends ended up getting deported that afternoon. And the reason why I say that was definitely racist because these guys were white, you know, they were Caucasian, and we were kids, you know. And the only reason that we were getting a hard time was because obviously the majority of us looked Mexican and we were speaking Spanish. And then the second time that I experienced racism, here in California we're very lucky because we don't see racism as it truly shows its ugly head in the rest of the United States. And when I was 16, a friend of mine and I, we drove cross country racing a dune buggy that we had built, more or less that my uncle had built. And we got to a place called Arkansas. Now when I was 16, it was 1985. And at that time, the Beastie Boys and Run DMC were doing a huge tour. I was wearing a Beastie Boys Run DMC tour t-shirt. Of course, Run DMC on the front, black rappers, and Beastie Boys on the back. And my friend was a light-skinned black guy. And we're walking down, and it's ascending, and this town is Blytheville, Arkansas. And we get approached by this guy, older gentleman, telling us, looking at my shirt, nodding his head, saying, "Those kind aren't allowed downtown on Sundays." And I'm like, "What?" He said, "You and your boy should know better than to come to these parts on a Sunday." I didn't know what that meant, but my friend did, and we got out of there. Went to ask some people that we knew that were hosting us, and they said that there hasn't been a black man walk this downtown Main Street on a Sunday in over 20 years in Blytheville, Arkansas. That we were lucky that we didn't cause more trouble. And to me, that was the most racist thing I'd ever seen. I couldn't believe it. You know, there was the mid-80s, and that was being tolerated. And I'm also thankful that, you know, we didn't get in a world of trouble. Needless to say, we turned around and came home.
So, where did you go to school? What colleges have you attended?
Well, coming out of high school, I went to San Diego City College for a semester. And that was in downtown San Diego. And then I transferred over to San Diego State, trying to play football. And that was a short-lived one semester there. Came to San Luis Obispo, to Mid-Cuesta College in Cal Poly, or now it's in Cal Poly. I did take some classes through the University of Maryland. That was an extended course when I was in service.
So what was it like being exposed to the college atmosphere as opposed to, like, you know, your neighborhoods where you grew up?
Well, when I first went to college at San Diego City College, that was pretty much reflective of my neighborhood. I'd say there was more African Americans there than in my neighborhoods, but I would say the same cross section. It wasn't until I came up to San Luis Obispo that I really saw the changing in cultures. You know, whereas one third of the people you saw before when I went to high school and whatnot were, you know, white Oriental, here less than a third are of any other minority other than white. You know, you see very few Latinos in college. You see a scarce amount of African Americans at Cal Poly. And if so, you know, they hold the stigma of being athletes. You know, there are Asians, not many. I guess in engineering we see more than the rest of the colleges, but it's just, there's no comparison. It's almost night and day.
So how do you find yourself getting along with, like, these different races and groups of people?
I myself, I've had the good fortune of going to more countries than in states, and have had the good fortune of being brought up in an environment where, you know, we treated people for who they were, not what they looked like or what shape or size they were. So to me, intermingling with people of other cultures at school is not difficult. The difficult thing for me is that some of the people who share the same culture are very cliquey. And in that, you know, they stay within themselves and rarely look outward for, you know, help or to give guidance or assistance. And I say that in other cultures as in non-Latinos because I see that more amongst ourselves, that we like to help, you know, from within and we help others. Whereas, you know, some of the different blends of Asian groups are not as open to extending a hand to help other people. You know, sure that they want to help themselves before they help others, and I can understand that, and I can understand how part of their culture also dictates that. But I believe in the place we are, the institution, the institute of learning that we're in, and the place where we are in life, I think all that should be beside us. We should be helping one another and ourselves to become better people.
Cool. So, I know you're married, John, so how did you meet your wife, and where did you meet her?
I actually met my wife here in San Luis Obispo. We were both employees of at a local fast food restaurant.
And, what can you share about being married to a Chicano and growing up in, you know, as opposed to the environment that you grew up in?
I think the fortunate thing for me about being married to Chicana is that she shares a lot of the same values that I share as far as family values, religious values, and as far as, you know, how we were raised and how we want to raise our children. And I think, you know, in life, when we have relationships, those things are very important, especially if we look to the long term, you know, how we want to have a family or what direction in life we want to take. Another good fortune is that, not that my wife in particular is subservient, but we've made sacrifices together to where, you know, I could be in the position I'm at now, you know, finishing college. Whereas I believe if I were in a relationship with perhaps a Caucasian girl or something else, I don't think that I would find myself in that same situation.
So what are some of the difficulties that you've gone through, you know, trying to, you know, put yourself, you know, and your wife through school and supporting your family at the same time?
Wow. The most difficult thing is a financial one. When we were first married and the years prior, we were a dual income
family, and when you're used to having money, making money, you're used to spending money. Going back to school, not only you have the expense of school, but you know, in addition, you have a family. So I had to take a lesser role as far as income went. And the most difficult thing is that we don't have the income, so we share a one-bedroom apartment. And things get kind of tight. There's a lot of I wish I had. There's a lot of maybe next times, you know. And there's a lot of keeping hope alive for when things change. I found that as my children got older, I found a new difficulty in time management. You know, getting up in the morning, getting kids ready for school, you know, getting them to school, and going to school myself, and having everything I need to get done, got very difficult. You know, as my daughter got older, my priorities just with school had to have changed. And you know, I had gone to school with certain goals in mind, which I weren't able to ascertain, you know, because of those, you know, because of those time conflicts.
So, where have you worked before, and where do you plan to work in the future?
Where have I worked before? Well, in recent history, I've worked as a mobile disc jockey. I've worked on local radio stations. I've had the good fortune of working at IBM. I currently work for a company called Newport Corporation here in town, which I'm planning on working with post-graduation. Before that, I've done everything from installing stereos to owning my own Mexican restaurant to being in the military.
So, where do you find yourself settling down and after school and raising a family?
Well, I still call San Diego my home, and I would really love to make it back there someday. But right now, I'm looking to settle down in an area where, first and foremost, I could find a career path. I think after working all this time, it's the thing that drives us now. You know, San Luis Obispo would be ideal to raise children. However, you know, there is no industry and there'd be no way to make a living here. So, you know, it's off to big cities and big times.
What cultural traditions and celebrations do you continue to participate in with your family now that you did as you grew up with your other families?
Well, we, in my household as a kid, of course, the cultural traditions, we got the best of both worlds because we got, you know, the typical American celebrations. You know, we got the big 4th of July celebrations. We got the big Thanksgiving with, you know, all the trimmings and all that. Also, we got the non-capitalistic version of Christmas. We got the more religious tones from the Hispanic side of my family. You know, we got the true stories of, you know, how we came to celebrate Christmas, why we were celebrating the birth of, you know, Jesus. And we also got to celebrate Dia de los Reyes, which we didn't really celebrate, you know, with the American side of my family. And I think the wonders of all that is now my children are in the dual immersion schools, and they're learning about both cultures. And, you know, we got to make cookies and set food out for Dia de los Muertos, and you know, we're looking forward to you know, celebrating Christmas and also Dia de los Reyes this year. You know, do las posadas and all that good stuff. So I think we got to take all of the good, trim off some of the fat, and you know, do everything that we couldn't do as kids to, you know, hopefully share with our children.
You mentioned you lived in Brazil for a while.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that influences what you do in your spare time now?
That's a great question. Life is full of ironies. When I was 5, we moved to Brazil, or right before my 5th birthday, I should say. And growing up in the United States, 9 out of 10 kids, you know, play the baseball, play the football, play the basketball, because, you know, that's what's on TV. And that's what society dictates. We moved to Brazil, and they only play one sport there, and that's soccer. So when we moved back, when I was 8 years old, I really only knew how to play one sport. The irony is that my father, he came to the United States as a semi-professional baseball player in 1961. And I have the body of a football player, and I play soccer in my spare time. So for me, growing up as a kid, playing soccer was a natural, because everywhere we've lived, you know, I always find myself around Latino because, you know, we all share the same game. One of the cool things about that experience that I've taken with me is that when I was in Germany in the service, I couldn't speak 3 words of German, or should I say I could speak enough to order a beer. And one afternoon I came across a field and asked when these guys were going to play. And this guy told me in a couple hours. I showed up in a couple hours with my cleats and couldn't speak any German. The next thing I would know, I was playing on a German soccer team, you know, week in and week out. And, you know, here I was thinking to myself, I'm like, damn, I learned a game. I learned to play a game when I was 5 in a country I'll probably never see again. Played it off and on most of my life. Here I was in Germany, couldn't speak these guys' language, but we were able to play soccer together, you know? And the only reason I relate that to being a kid is because if we could all communicate and get along that well, imagine how easy life would be. You know, put a ball out in the middle of the field, chase it around for a while, solve all your problems.
You mentioned you're in the Army for a while. Why'd you decide to join the Army?
Well, back before the war. No. Like I said, when I moved out to San Luis Obispo, I actually met and fell in love with my wife. And I knew that working at Burger King wasn't gonna provide the lifestyle or show the seriousness that I thought she had deserved or does deserve. And I thought that I could provide a different life in the service. So I ended up joining.
So what were some more experiences that you went through when you were in Europe? When, you know, before you got shipped out to war?
Well, my first day in Germany, I experienced a little bit of, how should we say, reverse racism. They send you over to your duty station, and they give you 48 hours before you actually have to report to work. And, you know, I flew over there, reported to my unit, and they gave me a place to, you know, a room. They signed me a room. I walked into the room, and I met my prospective roommate. His name was Jamal Coffey. He's a Muslim. And on the wall, he had about an 8-foot banner, maybe 3.5 foot tall, and it said Black Power. And after introducing myself to him, I said, hey, I said, would you mind taking the banner down? Now, Jamal, about 6'2", very dark-skinned guy from Brooklyn, New York, and very aggressive Muslim. Gave me a few colorful words and called me a cracker and tried to intimidate me. I said, no, hold on. I said, no, wait a minute. I said, let me just tell you how, you know, this would look. I said, man, how would you feel if you walked in here and I had an 8-foot banner that said White Power? I said, and Jamal responded by telling me not only would he think I was a cracker, but he probably would think I was the head of the KKK. I said, see that, man? I said, why don't you take the banner down? Jeff, Jamal shook his head, pointed his finger at me, took the sign down, and we've been friends ever since.
So what was it like participating in the Persian Gulf War?
There was about 3 different phases that I went through during that war. the first part of which I think was the most difficult, because once we found out we were going and we were locked down, you go through a mental transition, you know, because even though we were in the Army, the last thing on my mind, maybe because I was young or naive, but the last thing I ever thought of was that we were actually going to go to war someday. You know, it was just, you know, do my job, do my time, until I got out and then get on with the rest of my life. But the reality was that we were on our way to war, and we had, about 2 weeks to prepare before we were actually going to ship out. And during that time, you start playing all those movies that you had seen, you know, whether it be The Platoon or Force 10 from Navarone or whatever the movie may be. And you see all the people with the missing limbs and the open chest wounds and, you know, the variety of injuries. And you start thinking to yourself that you may die, that you are not immortal, that you know, may be injured, or you may have to take the life of somebody else. And during that transition from everyday happy-go-lucky, you know, 20-year-old to a person that has going to war, understands that he may not come home, or may not come home as complete as he leaves, and has made the decision to take somebody else's life if need be, if the situation dictates, was very difficult. And then once I got through that, and we actually got into Saudi Arabia, it was about the second stage, the second phase that I felt when I was there. Because then it was like, okay, we're here to do a job now. You know, let's do our job, let's get this job done, and let's get on with life. And no matter what the scenario was, you know, guard duty on the border, communication support, you know, whatever, even in the invasion, you know, that was a mental aspect I had to take, you know. Because I felt truly inside that, you know, that wasn't it for me, that there was something else. Mm-hmm. Once the war was over, and we were in Iraq for about 6 weeks, it was about, I would say, the third phase of what I felt when I was there. And during that phase, it was like outlining all these things in life that I hadn't got a chance to do, that I now knew that I was not immortal, that I only had so much time left on this planet that I wanted to do. And also during that time, I got to appreciate or have time to reflect on all those things in life that I had done and that I was not grateful for. And I started making a list, and somewhere around the 30th or 40th page, I had to stop that list of things that I wanted to do, because I realized I wanted to do so much that I would just sit there and think about it and not get anything done.
Did you experience any of the different culture there?
Yeah. Although we were at war, and you have to understand that that area of the world is scarcely populated. It's nothing like it is like we know it here in California or in the United States, or the areas that I know. You know, over there they have small, you know, bastions of population and then vast deserts. And we got to see some, the first 2 days we were there, I mean, we were far from any civilized area for the majority of the time, but to see people, you know, covered head to toe and black garb, and people with different types of headdresses, and you know, the signage going through the city, you know, with markings that, you know, were very foreign. You know, in Europe, the signs are international. They have about 200 different signs, and they're non-distinct, you know, arrows, people crossing, you know, stop signs. Whereas in this country, you know, the Arabic language is so far removed from English or from any other language that you can't even understand it by looking, nor do you know where to start reading, you know. And everything is different. even when we're leaving the towns, their agriculture. You know, we're here in the United States, we see, you know, vast fields of, you know, be it cotton, strawberries, you know, down into, I remember seeing fields of soybean, you know, going cross country. Where there they had very small, round fields of, you know, I'm not sure if they were growing wheat or rice or, you know, what they were trying to grow. There are just huge differences. You know, they still had, you know, walls, not fences between houses, they had walls. You know, like they really want to shelter one another from each other and, you know, a lot of privacy. Whereas, you know, here in California especially, we're a lot more open. And then on our way out, we got to see the worst that those cultures present themselves with. Because we had basically the same culture fighting within itself in the Middle East. And you had a struggle for oil. And the worst that that culture provides was you had a dictator who had his people line up on either side of a road. And anybody who was trying to leave the city or leave the country were subjected to death. Whereas, you know, in anywhere else that I've been, I've never seen. And to me, that was just astonishing. And there was no distinction between man, woman, or child. We saw the same brutality equally displayed, you know, equally amongst them.
So how do those experiences help you interpret what's going on today?
Well, the thing is as Americans, as a Mexican-American, someone who lived in the United States long enough, I understand that America as a whole, we're very arrogant. And I first noticed that when I was in the military. Even though we were displaced in other people's countries, you know, as peacekeeping forces or showing a force in Western Europe. There was arrogance about us as soldiers and as people. They were so much better than everybody else and we are untouchable. To interpret what's going on in the Middle East now, or in the stands, as we call it, the Pakistans, Afghanistan, those people have that particular sect of people have played onto the ideology that America is the bad man, that we are at fault for a lot of the bad in the world. It's easy to point the finger at anybody, and even easier to point it at the most visible. And true, I'm sure that the United States foreign policy hasn't been the best or most advantageous for Afghanistan, especially after the, you know, war with Russia. You know, our foreign policy with Turkey hasn't been the best, or with Saudi Arabia probably hasn't been the best, you know, or with Iran. But to see what has happened in the last 3 months, how else can you interpret it as other than somebody striking back at the United States? I've had the good fortune of speaking with several people who I work with who are from Iran. And, you know, we talk about how these particular Muslims have lost humanity. They're no longer people, they're animals. And the only reason that we've come up with that is that if you're a human, you appreciate life. You know, this guy has, what, 30-some kids, they say. Osama bin Laden's father with 28 children. How could he not, you know, hold life dear? How could you not appreciate life? You know, becoming a father was one of the, you know, most changing experiences, you know, to hold a life that you created in your hands. And for someone to say, okay, I want you and you and you and you to give up not only your life, but the life of everybody on these planes, and quite possibly the life of everybody who these planes come in contact with, It's just appalling. And the only other things on this planet that can do something like that is in an animal. There are some species of animals that are cannibalistic. I'm not saying that, you know, these Muslims are going to go eat people, but, you know, to take your life and, you know, to take other people's lives like that, it's animalistic. There's nothing else to it. To interpret what we're doing as a country now to try and stop or herd the Al-Qaeda or, you know, the rest of Bin Laden's henchmen, I do believe it's just, and I feel that if the United States didn't take immediate and forceful action, it would only allow other people to slap us in the face. I mean, what more could they do? They tried to blow up the Trade Center once. They, you know, parked a ship full of explosives next to one of our destroyers and exploded it. You know, what was the next step? And we obviously saw it. And if we would have left this action go unheeded, you know, and I could only, I fear for what my children would experience because of that. Sure, many lives, American lives, were lost because of it, but what was worse is that it proved to all the other crazed people in the world that we're not untouchable now. You know, the swagger in our walk is now gone. You know, we're no longer, you know, America way over there. We're now America with the black eye, you know, the bully who got finally punched. And for us not to take action or not to make a strong enough statement to the rest of the world that can't tolerate it. This will not be tolerated. I'm glad to see that our president has taken more of a coach position rather than a, you know, dictator. He's more of a rallying all of us as a nation, you know, and you know, influencing the rest of the world in that way, you know, rather than putting the finger at everybody else and saying, if you don't help us, you know, we too will, you know, you too will pay. More as, you know, hey, it could have been your country. So, I think my experience in the Persian Gulf and my experience with other people from that area and my experience as an American has helped me understand what's really going on. My biggest fear now, though, is that because of my experience in the Desert Storm and my feelings that we left that unfinished, is that public opinion, which is quick to forget and quick to change their mind, will cause us to stop without full restitution and without closure.
So what did you pick up from your family, you know, what they went through while you were over there?
I think the thing I mostly picked up from my family when I was in Desert Storm was the sense that I was special. You know, I know that as we grow up, you know, and our parents tell us things, sometimes we don't understand them. But my father was the typical, you know, macho Mexican, you know. Where my mom, she actually would sit to his side on the floor and he would sit in his chair. And he wasn't the most outspoken guy. And he actually wrote me a letter. Well, he wrote me several letters, but you know, those were the first times that I really heard him open up emotionally like that. You know, to express his love for me and his pride, you know, in me. And that made me feel very special. And I think that's what I sense most from that.
you talk a little bit about your sister and what she has contributed to Latino?
My sister is the politician of the family. My dad openly wanted us to get involved in politics when we were younger, in the sense that he wanted us to know that we could start the process of change. By living through example, we could influence other people, and in what we did with our lives, we could definitely influence and touch more people. My sister took that and ran with it. She started off working for a labor union, whereas most, Latino and people that come to this country to make a better life aren't very open and very outspoken. My sister is not soft-spoken in the least. So she became the voice of a hotel and restaurant workers labor union. And she helped, get better contracts, better pay, better benefits for this union. She orchestrated labor strikes to the tune of, tens of thousands of people, most notably against, people like the Hyatt Regency, Hilton Hotel Companies, major corporations. And, I would say 98% of the union members were Latinos. She went on to work on Jesse Jackson's campaign as a speechwriter. And nowadays is a contributing writer to Latina magazine. She got in with a comedy group, politician turned comedian, called Culture Clash. And they were the first group of roaming comedians that would go town to town and put on different shows, mostly about, Latino American comedy, doing different bits and skits and whatnot. That turned into Comedy Compadres, later turned into, she was the first Latina to have her own comedy television show, which was on the WB channel in 1995, short-lived for about 18 weeks. She's done everything for the Alma Awards, to the Latin Grammys, to, the Cesar Chavez annual dinner. She's been a keynote speaker there several times. To most recently, she wrote some local speeches for, or she ran local campaign for the mayor of Los Angeles, I believe. She's very committed to, very knowledgeable about how Latinos are very influential nowadays with the votes. Always a big respondent of, your vote is your voice. So my sister is very active in the, Latino American politics. Even so that our local congressman, Abel Maldonado, tried to hire her to run his campaign as well. Was he the assemblyman for representing Santa Maria, Santa Barbara County? Which is pretty neat.
Why are you such a diehard Dodgers fan?
Say again?
Why are you such a diehard Dodgers fan?
I bleed Dodger blue. I grew up in an area where the local baseball team wasn't that good. But my father had a passion for baseball, and he was a Dodgers fan. He used to take me to the stadium the first year that Tommy Lasorda was manager of the Dodgers. Up until I took my family this year to a couple games. And I guess we all have our crosses to bear, and that's one of mine.
So is there anything else you'd like to add, John?
Is there anything else I'd like to add? I would say that take the times that we live in, the experiences that we had and try to start from within to make things better for those who will follow.
All right.
Thank you very much, John.
Now give me $100.